So today we're going to look once again in the Anguturas, and Anagarika Upachala has done her paying me back for talking to me all day by choosing a sutta. And it's four lines. What do you reckon to that? Do you think we can talk about four lines for an hour and a half? Almost. I reckon we probably can, because after that sutta is another explanatory sutta. But even without the explanation, it's a very interesting sutta. And it is the Anguttara 4, number 161. And people generally love numbers. And this is about four modes of practice. So hopefully there's something that we can contemplate here that relates to our own practice, because you'll probably want to figure out which one you are. And of course, we're always changing. Our practice isn't, static, hopefully. And there'll be times that it's difficult and times that it's easeful and fairly, there might be a lot of contentment. And here we find out not only what those four types are, but also some of the causes for each. So if someone could type that in the chat, maybe Matthias can put the sutta reference in. But you can easily follow along with me, because I'll read it out. And I'm tempted to read out the second one too, to answer one of the first questions I had for you all, which was to define each mode of practice. So without much more mystique and mystery around this, let's begin. So this is called In Brief. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's the same title as the one last week, which was addressed to Mahaprajapati Gautami. It's actually 161, but I will read 162 as well. Okay. So, and as usual, I will change the language to be more inclusive. So I'm changing from bhikkhu, which means monk, to either monastics or community. And basically, this is addressed to us all. So, community. There are these four modes of practice. What for? Number one, practice that is painful with sluggish direct knowledge. Is anyone relating yet? Number two, practice that is painful with quick direct knowledge. Number three, practice that is pleasant with sluggish direct knowledge. And number four, practice that is pleasant with quick direct knowledge. These are the four modes of practice. Anyone relate to number four? Possibly. Okay, so there's a Bantisujato version above. It'd be interesting to actually read it, but I'm scared to click on it in case it disappears. Would anyone like to read it out? Maybe Matthias could read it out for us. Would you mind? Just those four sentences. See how Bantisujato translates that.
Need to change the screen. So first, painful practice with slow insight. Second, painful practice with swift insight. Third, pleasant practice with slow insight. And fourth, pleasant practice with swift insight.
Great, thank you very much. I actually quite like that one, because I think insight is a lot more relatable, isn't it, than direct knowledge. What does that really pertain to? And also this idea of sluggish or quick. So he's saying quick and slow. Was that what he was saying? Slow and quick, basically.
And the word was swift, I guess.
Swift, yeah, swift. Yeah, that's good too. Great. So direct knowledge basically means insight. And perhaps the reason that it's defined here as direct knowledge could be because direct knowledge generally pertains to a deep understanding. So direct knowledge is usually direct knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, which implies stream winning, right? Or even higher than that. Whereas insight actually could be, you know, it could be any level of insight. And perhaps that makes it more relatable because we can all have insights, hopefully, through our practice from time to time and, you know, in different degrees. But any insight that helps, I guess something is an insight if it helps you to have more happiness in your life, right? More happiness, more peace. And it leads to the happiness and peace for other people around you as well. And it's important that we acknowledge that along the way. If we're only thinking about whether we're getting enlightened or not, we can sometimes miss the changes that are happening slowly. And sometimes you need to actually look back on your practice several years to realize, oh, hang on, I used to be much more quick to anger, or I used to have this annoying habit that now I'm coming out of, or I used to have, I don't know, maybe a lot more self-criticism, but now I'm feeling that I can value myself, you know? And we don't see that change from day to day. If we do, it's sometimes just because of the general ups and downs of life. But over a period of time, if you start to see that, yeah, I really am sort of moving towards more wholesome happiness and less kind of detrimental habit patterns that inhibit my own well-being and, you know, stunt my growth, then you can be sure that some insight is arising in the practice. So the first comment I want to make about these four modes is actually that it's not necessary that one is better than another. The Buddha isn't saying that. He's just saying there are four modes, but each mode works. Each mode will take you to direct knowledge and insight. So it's not that the painful path that is slow or the path, how does Bhanisajata talk about it? It's painful and it has slow insight, or it's slow to lead to insight. It's not necessarily the case that that is inferior in any way. And I've noticed for myself that when things are slow or difficult, I can get a lot of wisdom from that, and especially compassion for people that also might struggle or have a hard time with a particular hindrance, perhaps, or, you know, even getting it together enough to practice from time to time because of the other demands on us in our life. So it is interesting that we're probably likely to think, yeah, I want the practice that's pleasant with quick direct knowledge. Great. I mean, if you are able to practice in that way and you do break through to some deep insight that helps you, wonderful. But it's not always the case that even everyone who's enlightened necessarily helps other beings. There is such a thing as a fully enlightened person that doesn't teach, right? That doesn't really serve in a particularly active way. And of course, they can still serve by example. But for me, myself, I feel it's so beneficial to have contact with people and for people to be accessible to people and to be able to help with things that I can relate to. And of course, building this monastery, you could say, has certainly halted some of the momentum I have had in my practice. And yet, in terms of meditation and how quickly it is to get calm for me when I've been busy as opposed to when I'm in the momentum of, you know, stilling the mind. And yet I can also see that I've grown in ways I could never have grown in without this opportunity to serve. You know, ways such as self-confidence, valuing myself. And both of those, I feel, have been to do with non-self. Not to do with me as a person, but to do with just surrendering to the role, surrendering to what's been asked, and actually putting aside self-limiting beliefs or ideas of who I am or who I'm not. You know, that I'm just here to serve the Dhamma. So there's just a few little thoughts to begin with. And I'm wondering if any questions already come up, or shall we go for the next bit where we were going to define each one in a little bit more depth? Perhaps firstly, I can ask you a little bit of a guided question, which would be, do you relate to any of these? And perhaps if anyone would like to share what they think they might fall into here, or what it means to them, it'd be interesting to hear from you. So whether you think your path is quick or slow, or insights come readily or take time, it'd be really interesting to hear. how much pain. Pain doesn't necessarily mean only physical pain. It might mean it's really tiring. Okay, Darren, thank you for responding. And I'll come to the chat as well.
Thank you, Venerable. For me, it depends. The correlation between a pleasant practice and swift insight and painful practice and slow insight just is a complete correlation with how much meditation I'm doing, essentially. The more meditation that I'm doing, then the more serenity I have. It is more of a pleasant practice and a swift insight. And I have that at work and with personal experiences as well. And then when I get too busy, then I get too busy for meditation, when that's when I should be doubling the meditation, because that's where, yeah, that clarity, the insight and the grounding in the moment. So when things are happening at work and there's so many projects going on and so many other things going on, if I'm not meditating, then I get swept up in that current, that river, I suppose, using that river analogy, as opposed to the meditation helps me sit on the riverbank and watch the emotions go by, helps me be in the moment and not react to situations, both work and also personal as well.
Mm-mm-mm. Thank you so much. That's great. And that is a sign that the meditation works, because when you do more, you tend to have a pleasanter abiding, pleasanter life, presumably, and also, yeah, not get swept up, as you say, and have more insights. And that's an insight too, right? Realizing that the more meditation you do, the easier the path. So wonderful. Thank you for sharing. I'll come to the chat box. Related to something we were discussing just before that about how we can't necessarily gauge how fast the insight is. Someone said, that's why I love keeping a diary. It makes it easier to reflect on the many ups and downs and my progress. Great. So on the question of whether we recognize it's a slow path or a quick path or pleasant or unpleasant, someone's saying, when I go for retreats, I move towards the pleasant practice with swift insight. Then I go back to my work life. These days, I'm trying to retain as much energy I got at a retreat. Energy as I got at a retreat, I think you mean. Yeah. Okay. Which is pretty damn hard, actually. It is really good to notice when you're kind of losing energy and when something you're doing is leading you towards, you know, unwholesome states, certainly. But I don't know. I personally find it's probably better not to compare between my meditation time and my daily life, because the insights that arise are different. The challenges I face are so, so different. And sometimes it's more around sila, relational sila in particular. Sometimes it's around generating joy and inspiration, which is, I must say, very easy to do at the moment. I feel surrounded by support and love, and it inspires me. It's not that it's, oh, aren't I so happy because people, you know, are supporting me. It's just the inspiration in knowing there's so much generosity in the world and so much love for the Dhamma. And these are a kind of massive support, actually, for the meditation. So, yeah, but it's good to try and retain that to some extent, to try and notice when we're slipping away from the peace that we know is there, and try and make sure we put some of the causes for that into place as well each day. So I'm probably going to get a lot of comments on this. I can relate for sure to painful practice with swift insight. Excellent, especially when I feel physically sick or really stressed. Yeah, great, great. So that means that you're harnessing the difficulties. You're actually relating to them with wisdom. And that's why they're leading towards insight. Whereas if we struggle against them and reject them, and react with aversion to them, then it's unlikely we're going to gain a lot of insight, or that insight will be strongly delayed. Okay, another comment. Anger isn't a strong or frequent feeling for me. But when I do feel it and meditate on it, I swiftly find the insight I actually am sad or hurting, that I'm actually sad or hurting. Yeah. Then I find it easy to process and accept. Great. And that's an example of working with one of the hindrances. Yeah. Right, I'll read one more. It'd be nice if anyone else wants to speak to raise your hand, but I'll read the next one. I think my practice usually falls in one of the painful categories, even if that isn't the word I'd necessarily choose. Yeah, there's always a process of untangling, unwinding, and releasing of things stuck in the body and mind, which may not exactly hurt, but it's a lot of work. Yes, that's really insightful, and I think I would probably agree with that, in the sense that much of the practice, most of the time, is indeed that. It's an untangling and an unwinding, a releasing of things, especially in the beginning of a retreat, or, you know, in the daily life, perhaps, depending, you know, on what's there. Because until we are, you know, Harriers, essentially, and even after that, we're still trying to understand dukkha. We're still trying to understand suffering, and we haven't yet understood it, which is why it keeps arising. You know, that's precisely what keeps it going, the fact that we haven't understood it fully. So it's wonderful to become embodied, to feel these things happening in the body and to work with them. And at the same time, I think it's very helpful for me to read these suttas and realize that there is such a thing as a pleasant path. And we'll get to the definitions very shortly, but I mean, in the next sutta, that one that explains it in detail, the Buddha's basically saying that it's the presence or absence of greed, hate, and delusion, the degree to which greed, hate, and delusion arise, that determines whether the practice is painful or pleasant. Right. So that's the kind of the thing that's the most tenacious, in a way, the thing that actually can create genuine difficulties, rather than simply feeling unpleasant sensations or maybe having emotional struggles. That isn't by itself unwholesome. It isn't by itself a problem, actually. And in that sense, it's just a matter of learning to relate wisely to these things, noticing that the way we respond, the way the views we have around how meditation practice should be, how much metta we have when being with ourselves, being with what's difficult or uncomfortable, this can determine how pleasant it is. And there is such a thing as a pleasant abiding. The Buddha talks about, you know, states of mind which are inherently pleasant, especially the mind when it is full of loving kindness or compassion, equanimity, mudita, sympathetic joy. And of course, the jhanas were actually described as the pleasant abidings here and now. So they do also lead to quick insight, to deep insight. So there is such a pleasant path as well. And I think it's important to spend some time with those kind of practices as a kind of container for the times that are a little bit more difficult, even if it's just in the sense of how we relate rather than formal metta practice itself. It's a big sutta, and there's a lot to say about these four modes, but are you happy for me to read the next one out if there aren't any more comments or questions so far? Okay, one more question. Come to you, Sunma. Can you unmute? Hi.
Good evening. Hi.
Good evening.
It's 2 hours ahead here, so I won't stay for the whole thing.
Sure. Whereabouts are you again? Oh, you're in Israel.
I live in Israel.
Okay.
What I think direct means is experiential. That's direct. That's what direct means to me.
Ah, yeah.
To experience the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
To experience what's my dukkha, particularly, you know, today.
Yeah, great.
Whatever, you know, a thought about that. in all of it. And if I mean, I don't go to practice for pain, I never did. I go for relief. And I practice a new method now. So it's very pleasant to me. I can reach it at any moment I want. And this is what I was looking for 25 years or more. You know?
Yeah.
An ability to see the mind within the mind.
Good.
So this method that I learned recently in 2 month retreat put me into that, which I'd started many years ago, really, but I left it. And then after that, a friend I met where I was in, I'm not all silent, but partially silent retreat in Taiwan, above a monastery was a retreat center. And I was the resident there for a while, and I went to the retreats when it happened. She somehow convinced me that it would be cool to go towards Tibetan Buddhism, although I was investigating Theravada at that point.
Yeah.
And I had come from Chan. And that was very interesting. That completely went in another direction and now full circle back.
Yeah, isn't it? It's as though sometimes we're just not quite ready for it at the time, but another time in our life, you know, it just comes back to us and makes a lot of sense in a way that it perhaps didn't at the time. Who knows? Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, my practice has because I've gone from more the idea that, or maybe it was necessary, of observing suffering, but not suffering. I mean, like, was it Jonathan? Benjamin, sorry, who was saying that, you know, it doesn't necessarily hurt, but, you know, sometimes we are mainly focused, at least in my practice, I was mainly focused on like impermanence, suffering, and actually I got a lot of joy from that, but it wasn't so much focused on deliberately cultivating the pleasant feelings, the pleasant abidings, and now it's shifted more to that, and I think whether I'd have been ready for that before, I'm not sure, because I think it was very helpful to have a foundation of understanding the nature of reality at a deeper level so that I won't get kind of too high when there's a pleasant experience or start kind of making that mean something about myself or, you know, this so-called spiritual materialism. That isn't such a danger, I think, when we've seen that all of these states anyway change, they're anyway impermanent. But I also much more inclined now towards the pleasant, just naturally, because I find that it helps the mind settle. And from there are different insights that arise. So, yeah, it's really interesting how practice evolves. And I don't know if it's really our choice, you know, can be just simply the teachings we come across or,
Immaturity.
Maturity, maybe, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If I didn't go to India for a personal retreat, I don't think I would have grown up at all, ever.
Right.
and that was difficult, mostly environmentally.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of aversion. So then I didn't know I had that, really.
Right.
Come up. And that still comes up, but it's not detrimental to me.
Yeah, great.
To my steady practice, to my silent point, which I found after 30 years or whatever.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you for sharing.
Okay, so someone else is saying, a pleasant path to me is applying the teachings of the Buddha, such as putting the Eightfold Path, putting virtuous causes and conditions in place and understanding the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. Yeah. Certainly the pleasant stuff for me. I mean, of course, the whole practice, right? Understanding suffering is in itself a joy. The Eightfold Path, when we're walking on it, we're certainly not creating more suffering. But the actual virtuous causes and conditions, that's immediately happy, isn't it? I notice, like, an act of virtue or an act of kindness, a thought of gratitude, it immediately gets, you know, brings up pleasantness, especially the more we get used to it and the more we kind of tune into the happiness and allow it to be there and notice it, rejoice in it. It can be really very pleasant in a way that leads to deeper meditation, I found. And someone else says, I give a lot of importance to the pleasant feelings because it gives a lot of encouragement to face the difficult times. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good motivation, actually, for being able to soak in the pleasant. And a lot of neuroscience is now recommending that this is very healthy for our nervous system. You know, it puts us in a state of rest and relax. And it's actually creating really strong neural networks that become easier to access. It's like they're sort of little channels in our brains. The more we sort of travel along them, the wider they get. Whereas if we always kind of react with the same sort of worry or irritability, those channels become wider. Luckily, it's not fixed. We can change. That's neuroplasticity. But yes, if it's good, pleasant feelings, as in pleasant feelings not based on greed, hatred, and delusion, right? And maybe there's a bit of clinging there. Sometimes it's inevitable, but the less we cling, the stronger neural networks we create that actually help us to have resilience when things are tough, especially when they say, when you're frightened. I've noticed, I mean, I do have a bit of a startle response, but it's much less actually after a retreat, much, much less. And I'm just altogether calmer and more resilient when things go wrong. And it's great. You start to get a lot of confidence from that. And then confidence becomes another source of happiness. So it's important to give importance to pleasant feelings and understanding that they'll pass. Understanding they're created from a cause. They're not the ultimate goal, but they can be useful in ways that you describe. So, yeah, good. So according to my little list of notes, which I did in about 2 minutes, I did want to define what each of these means according to the Buddha. And for that, we'll go to the next sutta, which is number 162, number 4, Anguttara 4's 162. So very logically, this one is called In Detail. And here the Buddha says, community. There are these four modes of practice. And then he repeats it. What for? Practice that is painful with sluggish direct knowledge or slow insight. Practice that is painful with quick direct knowledge or quick insight or experience, if you like, experiential insight. Practice that is pleasant with sluggish direct knowledge or sluggish experiential knowledge. Quite like that. No. Sluggish experiential insight. How about that? And practice that is pleasant with quick direct knowledge or quick experiential insight. So here he's going through them one by one. And what, community, is the practice that is painful with sluggish direct knowledge? Here we get the Buddha's answer. Here, someone is by nature strongly prone to lust and often experiences pain and dejection born of lust. By nature, they are strongly prone to hatred and often experiences pain and dejection born of hatred. By nature, they're strongly prone to delusion, which has to accompany the other two, and often experience pain and dejection born of delusion. So that's one side. The greed, hate, and delusion are strong. There's another side. These five faculties arise in this person feebly. The faculty of saddha. I'm saying the Pali word here, it's translated as faith, but it also means confidence or devotion. The faculty of energy, that's virya. The faculty of mindfulness, sati. The faculty of, it says concentration, but we always go for stillness in this community, at least if we've been brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm. So this just really means samadhi. That is the Pali word. And the faculty of wisdom, panya. So these are sometimes called the indriyas, which is, I think, the translation here is faculties. Indriya is like, they're actually like strengths. Indriya is almost like a superpower. But sometimes they're called the five friends as well, or just the five strengths, the five bala. And these five determine how quickly we're going to progress on the path. But of course, it also depends on how much these root afflictions or poisons, how strong they are as well. So that's how he's defining this. Because the five faculties are feeble, this person sluggishly attains the immediacy condition for the destruction of the taints. So that's a complicated translation, and I don't really want to go into the footnotes here, but if you wish to, you can afterwards. But it really means the condition for wisdom to arise, the wisdom to arise that actually destroys those defilements, greed, hate, and delusion. This is called the practice that is painful with sluggish or slow direct knowledge or insight. Number two, and what is the practice that is painful with quick direct knowledge? Here, someone is by nature strongly prone to loss, hatred, and delusion, and often experiences pain and dejection born of those three. These five faculties arise in them prominently. The faculty of faith, of, what's the second one, energy, of sati, mindfulness, of samadhi, and of wisdom. Because these five faculties are prominent in them, they quickly attain the immediacy condition for the destruction of the taints. This is called practice that is painful with quick direct knowledge, which implies that the five faculties overcome the extent of greed, hate, and delusion pretty fast, right? Number three, and what is practice that is pleasant with a sluggish direct knowledge? Here, someone by nature is not strongly prone to lust and does not often experience pain and dejection born of lust or hatred or delusion. By nature, they're not strongly prone to delusion. Oh, yeah, sorry, we've done delusion. The five faculties arise in this person feebly. The faculty of faith, of energy, of mindfulness, of samadhi, and of wisdom. Because these five faculties are feeble, they sluggishly attain the immediacy condition for the destruction of the taints. This is called practice that is pleasant with sluggish direct knowledge or slow insight. So you have an easier time, but you take longer. Maybe you're a bit lacking. You're lacking in the sort of oomph of the practice, the actual conditions that are necessary to break through. And it's interesting, but while I was reading through this one before, I was thinking that actually a lot of monastics fall into this. And I don't know that it means the five faculties aren't, you know, feeble. I mean, compared to like the rest of the world, they're probably still quite good. But I think that, you know, because greed, hate, and delusion aren't always so obvious, our faculties might become a little bit dull, or we might become, you know, we're kind of happy and living quite a pleasant life, and then there's not quite so much incentive, in a sense, to really continue cultivating. So I know quite a lot of monastics that get into a real comfort zone. And yeah, you know, because there aren't that many defilements arising, they don't see a lot of greed, hatred, probably not much at all. The delusion is hidden. The delusion is delusion because we simply don't know it's there. That's why it's delusion. It's hard to spot. And because of that, we can get a little bit lazy. The word is sluggish. I quite like that. There's nothing to rise up to. Whereas when things are obviously difficult, we sometimes rise up. We know we need to do something. Anyway. Maybe that happens to a certain type of person too, whether lay or monastic, you know, somebody who takes it easy, says, yeah, I don't really suffer, there's not much I need to do. I've met a lot of people like that as well in the lay world. And then the last one, which is presumably something we might like to happen to us? And what is practice that is pleasant with quick insight or direct knowledge? Here, someone by nature is not strongly prone to lust, hatred, or delusion, and does not often experience pain and rejection born of those things. These five faculties arise in this person predominantly: the faculty of faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. Because these five faculties are predominant in this person, they quickly attain the immediacy condition for the destruction of the taints. This is called practice that is pleasant with quick knowledge. These are the four modes of practice. I can barely read anymore without my glasses, but I think I am going to have a look in the... I wear my glasses. I'm going to look at that footnote now because we have a moment. And it's a complicated sentence. I'll come to questions in a sec. I think it's 851. Just in case you don't have the book, you might be curious about the description of the immediacy condition for the destruction of the taints, 851. Sometimes the commentary is very heavily Burmese or Sri Lankan based, very Abhidhamma based, actually. And so some of it doesn't make a lot of sense. Okay, this is really complicated and long-winded. Immediacy condition. Anantara asavanam kayo hoti. I mean, asavanam kayo hoti basically means the destruction of the asavas. And there are things like kama asava, ditta asava, bhavasana asava, and one other. It's really it's very similar to the kind of craving, longing to be, to strong view, wrong view, and to sensuality. But when it says destruction of those things, it's talking about full liberation. So there's a lot of different ideas about what that means. It usually means the moment before enlightenment, the moment before one becomes fully enlightened. Yeah, in here it says immediacy condition, but it also says it can suggest a state of complete ripeness for that breakthrough. So in other words, it's really at your fingertips. You know, you've not got far to go. And sometimes in the Abhidhamma, they talk about the path to arahatship or to the last three stages, like the path to once returning, non-returning, and arahatship, as happening right before the attainment. But actually, that's more from the Abhidhamma, from the commentaries, and in the suttas, the path can be a longer process. It's basically after stream winning, you are then on the path to becoming a once returner, and that could take years, it could even take lifetimes. So that's one of the differences between the commentaries in the Abhidhamma and the suttas. So anyway, it just means basically that somebody is, they have everything it takes and they are really close to breaking through to full liberation. Okay, so there we go. So this is bringing in the idea of the greed, hate, and delusion as creating a slower path, the extent to which determines how fast we're going to move. But also, we need these five faculties and we need to cultivate them strongly. So I'm going to come to the chat and then ask for any other comments or questions. So when dilutions are hidden, what does that mean, dilutions? Such as in monastic conditions. Do you mean delusion? Okay, delusion is hidden, such as in monastic conditions. What should one do? Shouldn't the insight they gain from meditations guide them? Be careful of the word should. Okay, because obviously we're talking about subtlety here, and we're talking about, you know, in monastic life, already so much greed, hate, and delusion is put aside. Otherwise, you know, it's not possible to renounce so much. So there's already, you know, a lot of giving up of those things, which is why they don't arise so much. But delusion is extremely sticky, and delusion is exactly what's preventing us from breaking through, right? Delusion in the Pali means avidya. The opposite is vidya. That means insight, wisdom. So it's the five hindrances, really. And, you know, of course, we're learning about the five hindrances and how to overcome them in our meditation. So that is happening. But what I'm saying is that there are hindrances, and of course, delusion in particular, as one of the three roots, that are really subtle. And if we could see them, we would see them, right? I mean, if it was easy to see them, everybody would be enlightened. But it does take teachings, and it does take, I would say, inspiration. It's like the whole Eightfold Path has to apply to everyone all the time. We need to keep on building it. You know, we can't get to a point and think, well, I'm happy enough, I'm on the path, I'm probably not going to go backwards now and stop there. We need to keep on getting that sense of urgency in a way, right? I think the sense of urgency for people who do ordain is very, very strong. And it's certainly for me one of the main reasons, you know, one of the main forces that made me compelled to seek ordination. It's like, I have to do this with my life. And I was searching for 10 years to find a place. You know, every retreat, it's like, I don't want to come out and, you know, pointlessly kind of look for things to occupy myself with in the outside world, because I'm simply not interested. I just want to focus on my practice. So that was very, very strong. There was a strong turning away from the world, nibbida, and turning towards practice. But over the years, it's like with anything, you know, we can sometimes forget that. For me personally, I don't feel like that. I don't feel that I've become complacent or that the inspiration's gone. But that's also because I serve, and that gives me a lot of meaning, a lot of energy to feel that whatever I'm doing on the cushion is of benefit in the world. You know, it's not all about how fast I might think I'm getting enlightened or not. It's actually giving me benefit all the time and giving other people benefit, hopefully much of the time, right? And I think we need that in monastic life. I mean, in neuroscience now, they actually say if we're not growing, we just keep going round and round the same neural networks, and we don't really grow. Like, we need to be challenged. We need to get out of our comfort zone. And it's like any lifestyle, especially in the West, right? When we're not alms mendicants as such, we actually have somewhere to sleep, and it can be quite comfy. And you can actually be quite sedentary too, and pretty much in one place and committed to one place. There isn't enough challenge. Interestingly, I don't know if it's okay to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, because I'm trained by Ajahn Brown, you can't stop yourself. But Venerable Upeka's mother spoke to me when I was in Perth, and she said she really wants her to come back to England because she gets out of her comfort zone when she's here. And her mom can see that she grows. And when she gets back into the communities, I think she is growing because she's at Santi now and there's a bit more challenge there. Like, she's being asked to teach and she's getting involved in different things. But she does tend to get really comfortable. And it's not just her. I'm just using that as a personal example. It's good to be stretched, not beyond your capacity so you break, but to be stretched to some extent and to keep feeling like, I know why I'm doing this. It's important to be doing this. You know, this is making a difference. If I get up in the morning and meditate, it will affect, or don't meditate, it will not affect only me, but the people around me, right? And if I allow these habit patterns to continue playing themselves out, say in a leadership role, it's going to be extremely crippling. So I don't know, I feel very grateful for the opportunity I have, and it might be, I don't know if it's slow or not. I honestly don't know, but it doesn't matter to me anymore. It's not the point. Does that make sense? It's quite a long answer, but just some personal sharing with you on that. Okay, I'm getting a lot in the chat. It'd be nice to hear some voices if anyone wants to. Okay, I think that we are not all one style or another. Yes. I change category depending on my level of energy, what happened during the day. I'm good at spotting the category, but I'm not always good at getting out of the sluggish category, especially when I'm very tired. That's a very, very good point. And I actually was saying in my little notes, like, are they fixed? I mean, I actually wrote down they're not fixed, because we do change categories, and that's normal. And I don't think we could possibly always be in one unless we're some kind of maybe a stream winner already when we're born, right? I mean, there are stream winners that are reborn. They get seven more lives sometimes. For most people, we go through ups and downs, and it's great insight to notice that tiredness has an effect, has a huge effect. I mean, how can we be really mindful to what's happening, really aware of the hindrances arising, you know, really seeing with open eyes when we're tired? It's very difficult. But rather than fighting that tiredness, just sleep, just have some rest if you possibly can. And also remind yourself, I'm tired. I'm more likely to get irritable. I'm more likely to, I don't know, what you might do when you're tired, blame other people, or I don't know, certain activities might be so not what you fancy doing, like looking online, working online for me. So see if you can work with that and give yourself some support to avoid the possible hindrances arising that are likely to come up, that you know are likely to come up. Okay. Is there a difference between delusion and ignorance? I thought of the translation of avidya as ignorance. Interested to hear there's a subtle difference between the two. Great question. I think there is a difference, and it is the same word that's being translated. It is avidya. You've written down the Sanskrit form of that word, I think. It's two different translations, and I much prefer delusion, because it's not that we don't know something. Ignorance implies that there's a lack of knowledge, that there's something we don't know. Delusion includes that, but delusion means that we're actually misperceiving something. So we're seeing something that's not there, or we're not seeing what is there. So the definition the Buddha gives for this is like a distortion of perception. And he says it's like seeing permanence where actually it's impermanence, seeing something permanent in what's impermanent, seeing happiness in what's suffering, yeah, seeing beauty in what's inherently ugly I don't like the word ugly, just kind of not attractive, yeah, like seeing the body as beautiful. Okay, you might say it's beautiful based on somebody's skin or bone structure or something very superficial, but just go a little bit inside it. And what is there that's really beautiful? There's like pus, there's like spittle. There's this morning I had a lot of like liquid coming from my nose. It was like salty liquid. And I said to Anagarika Upachala, it's the same stuff that comes out of your eyes. It's just a bit stickier. Like we're just oozing with all this like salty liquid. That's what we're sort of coming out of us, you know? and what's the other one? Seeing things that are not self as self. This is delusion. So we're misperceiving. We're actually seeing things through a distorted lens. It's not just that we don't know. We're actually seeing it in the wrong way. So I think for me, that's the difference. And that is more tricky. It's much subtler than just, I've got some knowledge. To me, knowledge is more cognitive. And delusion is more like a matter of perception and wisdom. So it's the opposite. Delusion is the opposite of wisdom. It's not the opposite of knowing. Does that make sense? Yeah. All right. There are more chats in the comments, but I'm going to come to Suzanne just to have a change from my voice. And then I'll come back to the chat. Hi.
I noticed that I know all these four different ways of practice. And it's very interesting to have them like put out like this, laid out. And for me, especially last year, I had a lot of intense practice, and there was the experience intense emotions coming up within a retreat setting, and then at the same time me being able to let go in that, and that was there was a few incidents where I really had like breakthrough experiences in meditation because of that, you know, that it was the, I think the quick insight or quick, and on the other hand, that there was intense like anger coming up, you know?
Yeah.
So I did experience that last year and it was really good. It was really good. And also, with my view on meditation changed because of an experience where I did go into a deep meditation. I felt really wonderful. Then there was some kind of distracting noise and I came out of it. I was like, oh no, I want to go back. I was like, like sad about it. And and then a very deep insight arose in me that this clinging towards this nice sensation that I had or nice experience in the meditation that created the suffering. And that was the problem, you know, this grasping of wanting to hold on. And there was really like a deep insight arose from that. So also like bad, like in a way I did meditation that doesn't go smooth brought me a really deep insight.
Yeah.
So that to me, it changed. Like, it's not about like going kind of like a good meditation is only good if I can understand that it's impermanent, it will change because of how the world is and it will not stay. And even the most beautiful experiences, they're not forever. So it's kind of like it changed my view on meditation, why I meditate.
Yay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I mean, I do think that it's so important not to judge our meditation, you know, as good or bad, because like you say, you know, it doesn't have to be pleasant, but it might result in a lot of insight. And if we're looking at, you know, what the Buddha's saying is leading to insight, which is more important than whether it's painful or not painful, it is these five faculties. And one of those faculties is wisdom, right? It's understanding. So included in wisdom is an appreciation of suffering, of impermanence, and of non-self. So as long as they are there, and of course the mindfulness, all those faculties being strong, that is what leads to the insight. So, I mean, there's also a scope. I mean, maybe another session we can talk more about these five faculties, because it's sort of a bit too much for one session. But you know, if you are cultivating those five faculties really strongly, it'll give you a lot of inspiration, because then you'll be able to see that you can actually deal with a lot of emotional, what can we call it, just emotional turbulence or, the kind of emotions that might sometimes pull us around. But if we've got a lot of mindfulness, a lot of confidence, a lot of energy in our mind, it can lead to insight. Yeah, it's those five faculties that make it. It'd be interesting if you could like reflect on that meditation and notice which five faculties were strong there, probably all of them to some degree. Yeah. So there's a lot more questions. Wow. Is it, or have I gone up? Whoops. Yeah, I think there's a lot more. Okay. I think I missed one. Maybe not. Okay, cultivating, so this is actually about the faculties, so hopefully this still speaks to the last question or comment. Cultivating confidence, mindfulness, and wisdom seems to me relatively straightforward. Energy and samadhi, not so much. Very interesting. Cultivating energy while it's being sapped by disease often feels like a losing game, and it seems a necessary condition for samadhi. Yeah, great question. And it's interesting that you divided this into the confidence, mindfulness, and wisdom on the one hand, the energy and samadhi on the other, because energy and samadhi do tend to go together. But luckily, energy and mindfulness go together too. Energy is a precursor to mindfulness. It's a cause for mindfulness. So even the five faculties are causally, they're in a sequence, a causal sequence. So generally speaking, we start with confidence. That relates to the gradual training, that it starts by hearing the Dharma, developing confidence. And that already gives us some energy. So I think the energy the Buddha's talking about is not physical energy. It's the energy that can come around through confidence in the teachings, confidence in your own virtue, confidence and inspiration in hearing the Dhamma. There's another source of energy that isn't physical. And the one he's talking about here is generated through another source of energy that's generated through confidence, through inspiration, in the teachings, in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, in goodness, in virtue, etc. And that energy is a cause for mindfulness. But the nice thing is that mindfulness and energy are mutually reinforcing. So when there is mindfulness, the mind is starting to brighten up. And I'm sure you've found, because I also have a chronic condition, probably different from yours. I mean, they're all different. They're all unique. Even if it's the same condition, they manifest differently in different people. And sometimes my physical energy is really low, but I'm starting to learn that there's a mental energy that I can start to notice. And sometimes it's just the energy of, say, having a clear conscience. At first, that doesn't seem like an energy, but when you look, it actually is. Because a guilty conscience would sap a lot of energy and take out a lot of mental happiness away. So that energy is related to mindfulness, but it's also related to happiness as well. So try and see if you can get some energy from the mind, from the virtue of the mind, from the gratitude, from kindness, reflecting on these things, reflecting on your virtue. And yeah, just trust that when there's mindfulness, there is energy there. And as the mind continues to be mindful and continues, because what is mindfulness? It's just being aware in the present moment. The more moments of mindfulness that happen, arise together for longer periods, that becomes your samadhi. Samadhi just really means sustained attention, right? And then that attention becomes more and more trustworthy, in a sense, becomes natural. You know, you're in the groove. And then gradually the mind can relax, can still, and you'll find a lot of energy arises because the thoughts start to slow down. Thoughts take an enormous amount of energy away, you know, especially worry, just overthinking in general. So you'll start to feel the energy building. And one of Ajahn Brahm's favorite ways to teach about energy is to actually tell us to just relax and to really try and let go of any control in the practice. And it's hard for us to trust to do that, but I did do that one retreat, like really stop in the middle of a retreat, actually 6 weeks in. And I just did nothing. Like I actually stopped myself. If I find my mind trying to go to the breath, no, do nothing, literally do nothing. And I went into some kind of foggy state as though the brain was really dulling out. But after a few days, about 3 days of just bearing with it, it all started to lift just like the mist in the morning. You know, this morning we saw the mist in the valley, sort of frozen, cold, icy mist. And when the sun came up, it just started to clear. I don't know at what point it cleared, but I know that the rest of the day was beautiful and clear, bright blue skies. And it's similar in the meditation. After a while, if we just let the mind, let the brain rest, then the energy goes into awareness. It goes into mindfulness. And from there, it starts to build. So I hope that helps a bit, but it is a different energy source. So don't worry too much. Just make sure you have probably more rest and more, you know, less activity than most people, you know, less of a strenuous life, you know, just really respect your own physical limits, but then trust that your mind is still very much aware, can still have that faculty. So that's lovely to hear about Ven Upeka, as it's great for us to have her. But if it's also good for her, even better. Her parents think so. As the suttas say, it should benefit all, not just oneself or others. That's right. All, not just oneself, not just others. Correct. And just others is actually quite bad. So if we're just giving, and it's not doing us any good, something's wrong. Okay. All right. We have more questions. This is very rich, isn't it? Thanks to Anagarika Upachala, who has suggested this sutta, 4 sentences, but very rich. Another source of energy is remembering death. Yeah. It gives you a sense of urgency, but also a sense that time is precious, and it makes me smile and gives me energy. Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you for that. For me, sometimes I smile when I think of people who have died beautifully. I feel so much joy for them. Yeah. So someone said, I think I'm the third type of person. I can get a lot of natural faith arising in the Buddha and the Dhamma, just by itself, it seems, and also due to insight as well. Also, the more I give myself to the Dhamma and just get out of the way, the heart response is, this is the right way. Excellent, excellent. Yes, and that relates a little bit to the other comment about energy as well, because the more we get out of the way and give ourselves to the Dhamma, the more the Dhamma just starts to unfold. And it's just watching a process unfold, even if that means going through tiredness, going through doubt, whatever. Stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. Just, okay, I'm here to just be. I'm here to just trust and give myself to the Dhamma, open myself up to, I don't know, sometimes not even the best, sometimes just being present. When I say I did nothing, I actually did do one thing, which was to endeavor to be aware of the present moment. So that meant restraint. It meant not letting the mind go anywhere else. So if it would start to think, if it was even go to the breath, if whatever it wanted to do, it's like an imp. It wants to be busy. It wants to do something. It's like, no, present moment. Just getting this perception of the present. That was really, really helpful to just, in a sense, conserve. It felt like conserving energy, and that energy just built and built and built. So another way of getting energy. Remembering I am subject to karma, old age, disease, death, and not getting what I want. So again, suffering, again, the truth of death, decay, and the departing of loved ones. This gives me energy. Amazing, yeah. So that's also, I'm supposing, related to a sense of urgency, because normally thinking about the departing of loved ones is not so, doesn't necessarily give us a lot of energy unless it's the energy of a sort of spiritual urgency. So that's wonderful. Or unless you mean actually a beautiful, peaceful passing, that can be really nice. Okay, I just want to check I haven't missed any because the cursor skipped. Yeah, wonderful. I don't know if Matt wants to say anything else on that, because it'd be nice to hear from you after a long, long time. If you wish to, you can raise your hand. Otherwise, any other? Oh, there you are. I can see you. Yay, super.
Hello, can you hear me?
Hi, sure. Sorry,
yeah. I used to conduct a meditation class for a few people. And I think most of them are sort of in a rut and sort of going about doing their practice and feeling not much energy. And I found this particular way of contemplating is quite helpful. And so I introduced it to them. And I think it motivated a lot of people, because suddenly it brought home that this current state wasn't a permanent state that they could comfortably be in for the rest of their lives, but things were going to change. So I think that, yeah, that kind of helped. I think it's the Marana Sati Bhavana as well that the Buddha has prescribed for monks and nuns in the jungles about you don't know when death will be, when you don't know when death will come. I know it's the unpleasant things to think about, but I think it's again about delusion and wisdom. About being aware of death.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I just wanted to help. I thought I was sharing it. It's a sutra. I don't know the name of the sutra, but it's out there.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It's interesting that we have this aversion to wanting to think about death, but actually when we get a bit closer to it and we start to think about it, it brings a lot of relief, because we are in touch with something real, and it isn't, you know, it's something genuine that's going to happen. It feels almost as though other subjects pale into insignificance, for me anyway, whenever I talk about that. And by the way, there'll be a day retreat on that as well. I'm going to come to Darren, who had his hand up, because I don't think you've spoken yet. You still got your hand up? Who was it? Which Darren? No? Is it Darren Goodale? Do you still want to speak? We've got like about a minute. Liz wants to speak too, but we are actually out of time. I don't know if it's something you could type, because we do need to wind up very soon. It's such a rich discussion. So maybe if you could just type in the chat, and I don't know if Darren's doing that, but maybe I'll let Manoy say a few words to end, and then if there is any more final comments in the chat, I'll come back to it after that. And then I'll let you know about our next events. I think there's something tomorrow morning, metta meditation. All right, maybe I should do a death meditation one day. We can do that, but I'm doing a day retreat as well in 29th of March. For London Insight, I think. Yeah. All right.
Hi. Hello, everyone. And many thanks, Venerable, for that wonderful sort of discussion and giving us a platform to discuss on these things and analyze all the little things that we wouldn't if we just read a sutta. And all of you, thank you very much for being part of the project and being part of the community. If you're on the first day, welcome. And so just wanted to remind you, as always, that today's sutta discussion and all the Anukampa regular teachings are offered on the donation basis. On the spirit of generosity, as you know, the monastics use money, they don't have income, and we look after Venerable and all the other future monastics, and hoping for a future place for women to ordain. So that is what one of the objectives of Anukampa Bhikkhuni project, other than giving these valuable Dhamma talks, teachings, and retreats. So there is the donation link if you are financially able. No small amount is too small, and it is part of the generosity that you cultivate as well. So I wanted to tell you a little bit of the needs that Anukampa has these days. So when you go to that, you can have two ways of financial donations. One is the normal bank transfer. The other one is the PayPal. We are trying to introduce more and look for that spot. And then the other one is regular shopping deliveries. As you know, there is an Anagarika, there is a Venerable, and there may be more guests as well. So regular shopping deliveries or shopping or supermarket vouchers, they're helpful as well. If you want to, and then there's going to be an Amazon wish list coming out shortly. So look for that.
It's already out.
Oh, it is out. Okay.
On the newsletter, yeah.
Yeah, so look in the latest newsletter and you will find that. And there's so much of information in the latest newsletter about events. And tomorrow is the first event of the Metta Meditation, as Venerable said. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Manoy. I'm just learning now about lovely things from the chat box, which I will read out in a short while. So I'm just trying to unpin Manoy and remove myself from the big screen. I should be in gallery. Yes. Excellent. I'm sure there was one more thing to mention there. I suppose it's just that we want to build an office this year. So that's another main project that we have. But anyway, you can probably read that in the newsletter if you want to. So our newsletter came out a couple of days ago. And the other thing I wanted to say is just the warmest thanks to everyone who has donated on the gift list, because it's just really heartwarming. I mean, the minute the newsletter went out, I think about within half an hour, there was already someone offering an item. And by now it's half offered, including new mattresses, because we have actually a full house from the 22nd onwards, 22nd of Jan. I'm just having about a week with Anagarika Upachala to settle in quietly together, because I'm still adjusting. She'll be certainly still adjusting. And then we're going to be full with 5, 6, sometimes 7 people at all times. So yeah, I don't know if you can add the wish list here, but anyway, it doesn't really matter. It's in the newsletter. And yeah, the other thing is we are trying to get an alternative to PayPal. I guess PayPal's okay for most people here. SumUp, that's right, because that one will give people in Indonesia and Asia an opportunity to donate. At the moment, they can't do it through the card. Events coming up. So tomorrow morning is the Metta Meditation. I think Monday evening there's an event with Oxford Insight, which is also, the link is given in our newsletter. You have to get onto that. The archive newsletter's on the news page, isn't it? I don't know if someone could put a link to that also, because the link to the Monday session is not public. It's just for us with Oxford Insight. And I'm not sure, I might talk about embodied awareness or embodied wisdom, something like that. It might relate to today's session. So if anyone wants to come, that'd be great, because the more discussion we can have, the better. And then we do have some Anukampa retreats. We have one on March the 15th. I think some of you have already applied, which is really cool. And then another one in April. Anyway, it's all in the newsletter. So I hope to see you somewhere soon. Of course, Bhante Sujata will be here next week. Is it next week? 22nd. He's doing his first talk in London. And then 25th or 26th, there's a day retreat in Brighton. And then some day retreats here in Oxford. So, and someone just shared that Puget Sound. Am I saying that right? Puget Sound? I've never heard of it. Sorry for my ignorance here. That is ignorance. I don't know. I'm not deluded about it because I didn't know anything about it, but I don't know what it is. It's a complex system of interconnected marine waterways and basins located on the northwest coast of the US state of Washington. Amazing. So it's specific to that area. There are lots of islands located in the Puget Sound. I think I've seen some, actually. I'm on one of them. I think a sound refers to an inland sea. Puget Sound, Puget Inland Sea, is connected to the Pacific Ocean. Fantastic. I didn't know. I know someone on one of those islands, as well as you. And Bill's asking about sending money internationally, so Manoi's replied. And we can do a WISE transfer, I do believe, which gives you a better exchange rate. Yeah, go on to our donate page. All right. Take care, everyone. Thank you so much for all your support and practice and spiritual friendship. Really appreciated. Take care. And for those in Israel and other places where it's late, sleep well. Good night, everyone. You can unmute if you wish, and we can wave goodbye.